we didn't want to predict what the secretary is going to decide. So our analysis includes the per capita cap for Alaska.
Finding the true costs for Alaska of the latest ACA repeal bill proves daunting. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Walker administration wants a flat tax on some income.
It does not tax capital, and therefore it should encourage investments in the state.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Senator John McCain has announced he will vote no on the Republicans' latest health care repeal attempt. That appears to sink the bill, but anti-repeal activists aren't taking any chances. They protested in front of Senator Lisa Murkowski's office in Anchorage again this afternoon, urging her to vote no. Murkowski says her position on the bill will hinge on data showing how Alaska would fare under the bill. As Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports, it depends on where she looks.
Alaska is a tough state to treat, medically and politically, in a health care bill. Senator Lindsey Graham says he understands that.
Alaska is about a third the size of the country with 750,000 people. It is a bedeviling problem.
It's unclear whether Senate leadership will put his repeal bill, Graham Cassidy, to a vote now, but a hearing is scheduled for Monday. If Murkowski is still trying to make up her mind, she might read the reports of think tanks and consulting firms. Their calculations of the Alaska impacts of Graham Cassidy vary wildly. On the high end, the consulting firm Avalere says Alaska would lose about $1 billion over 7 years, compared to what it gets under current law. But the Kaiser Family Foundation finds Alaska's loss would be more like one quarter that amount, just $275 million over those same 7 years. And the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities says Alaska would lose about the same, $255 million, in a single year. The authors of three different reports all told me the divergent numbers are unimportant.
Under this bill, we found that Alaska is at risk of losing money.
Among the people I interviewed was Chris Sloan of Avalere. You're saying $1 billion over those years, and they're saying $275 million. That's a hell of a difference.
Well, part of it is, our number is rounded, right?
Okay.
To the billionth, and it's better if you look at the percentage.
That's right. They're rounding their dollar figures to the nearest billion. Another difference among the reports is how they treat special allowances in the bill that would help Alaska. For instance, one of the things the Graham Cassidy bill would do is change funding for the 50-year-old Medicaid program. It would have the feds pay states a set amount per person, starting in 2020. But the bill has an exception for certain low-density states, which boils down to Alaska and Montana. The bill allows them to delay the change until 2027. Sloan says Avalere assumes Alaska will not get that allowance, or others in the bill that would help Alaska but depend on the health secretary certifying eligibility.
You know, we didn't want to predict what the secretary is going to decide, so our analysis includes the per capita cap for Alaska.
Avalere's report was sponsored by the Center for American Progress, a liberal advocacy group. The nonprofit Kaiser Family Foundation assumes Alaska will delay the Medicaid changes. That's part of the reason Kaiser's report shows Alaska's loss as much lower. But Kaiser Foundation Vice President Larry Levitt says Alaska would still have significant losses because the block grants the bill provides aren't as generous as Alaska's benefits under the Affordable Care Act.
The block grant tries to equalize funding across states, not based on whether they've expanded Medicaid or not, or how high premiums are, but how many low-income people live in the state. And by that formula, Alaska ends up losing a substantial amount of money, almost $300 million.
That's over 7 years. Another left-leaning group, the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, says Alaska would lose almost that much just in 2026.
The difference is the baseline.
Senior fellow Aviva Arendine says all of these reports compare what the bill would do relative to current law. So you have to make assumptions about the path we're on now, like how many Alaskans will be on the Medicaid rolls in 2026? What will insurance cost 5 years from now?
The truth is that, you know, reputable, well-intentioned analysts can just disagree about what it's reasonable to assume.
Arendine says a report from a consulting firm called Manat may be good on those Alaska factors, because Manat does research for the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. And Manat's latest report predicts the 7-year impact on Alaska will be $1.1 billion. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Governor Bill Walker gave more reasons on Thursday as to why he opposes the latest bill to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Bill sponsors say it will give states more flexibility in health care, but Walker says that's not enough.
Flexibility is something that I'm interested in as a state, as a governor, of course, but with significantly less money to work with, that's not the balance I'm looking for. So more flexibility and significantly less money doesn't work for Alaska.
Walker says he has spoken several times with U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski, whose vote could help determine the bill's fate. Walker says both he and Murkowski want to know how the bill will affect the state. Walker is an independent and Murkowski is a Republican.
We've had very good discussions, the senator and I have, and we have basically compared notes about what we're both receiving input and data, sometimes from the same people. And we're just kind of comparing notes, trying to understand, you know, the impact on Alaska from what's being proposed.
The bill would discontinue federal financial support of the state's Medicaid expansion. Walker says Congress may be moving too quickly to determine what will happen to Alaskans.
It's unknown, really, with any specificity, what the impact on Alaska is going to be. And so with that unknown, my concern is the process is one that concerns me a great deal.
In a letter to Congress, Walker joined with 9 other governors from both major parties in opposing the bill. Some Republican members of Congress are trying to pass it by September 30th. After that, the rules would make it easier for Senate Democrats to block the bill. Governor Walker is proposing a new tax to close part of the gap between what the state government spends and what it brings in. The tax would be a flat 1.5% of wages and self-employment income, but there would be a limit in how much anyone pays. No one would pay more than twice what they receive in an Alaska Permanent Fund dividend. State Commissioner of Revenue Sheldon Fisher says the administration decided against asking for more new revenue bills.
We feel like we are most successful, and when I say we, I mean the administration and the legislature working together, are most successful when there's a single item of focus.
Both state residents and non-Alaskans working in the state would pay the tax. Administration officials have a mouthful of a name for the tax, capped hybrid head tax. It's not a true head tax in which every person pays the same amount, but it's also different than most of the tax proposals the House considered this year, since everyone whose pay is above a certain ceiling would pay the same amount. This year, that amount would have been $147,000. Fisher said the tax wouldn't be applied to all forms of income.
It does not tax capital, and therefore it should encourage investments in the state. It also does not tax retirement income. So we know that that's a matter that's sensitive to many of our retirees that are on a fixed income.
The tax would raise about $320 million. That would still leave a significant budget gap, even if the legislature passes a bill that draws money from permanent fund earnings. State officials say the gap next year would be between $200 and $500 million. Administration officials say the legislature should decide how to close the gap. Options include spending from state savings, other new revenue, or additional cuts. If the legislature passes the tax, it would start in January of 2019. It would require as many as 50 new state workers to administer. Walker plans to call the legislature into a special session on October 23rd to consider the tax and a bill that would increase sentences for some crimes. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the mayor of Anchorage addresses concern over crime and safety.
The ability to generate a safe community is dependent on what we're doing to prevent crime, what we're doing to police it, how are we prosecuting it, what sort of punishments are in place.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The 10 federal subsistence regional advisory councils are conducting meetings from late September through November to discuss proposals for federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations and other issues. Public participation is encouraged. Information at doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
A Superior Court judge is weighing how to define who is allowed to run the Alaska Democratic Party primary. The party wants to allow independent candidates to run in the primary without registering as Democrats.
What makes this a Democratic primary anymore when any independent can vote in it and any independent can run in it? How is that still a Democratic primary?
That's Judge Philip Hallenberg posing a question to the Democrats' lawyer, John Choate. The Democrats already allow any registered voters to cast ballots in the primary. Now they want to allow nonpartisan and undeclared candidates to run in the primary. State election officials rejected a proposal by the party to change its rules, citing state law. Choate says the law violates the free speech guarantee in the Alaska Constitution.
Questions of ideology as to what constitutes a political party, I think those are best left, especially at the primary level, for the party to decide.
Assistant Attorney General Margaret Payton Walsh says the proposed change could allow people who don't share Democrats' beliefs to win the primary.
In any particular primary, you could have more non-Democratic voters voting than Democratic voters. And if they choose a candidate who is also unassociated with the party, you have a primary that is really not a Democratic primary at all.
If the Democratic Party wins the case, it could provide political benefits. Undeclared, non-affiliated, and Republican voters all outnumber registered Democrats. Proposed Democratic Party rules say that winning independent primary candidates would appear on the general election ballot without the party's name. But state officials design the ballot. If the party wins in court, the state could still require that ballots say that an independent candidate won the Democratic primary. Pallenberg says he'll try to reach a decision as quickly as he can, possibly as soon as next week. Anchorage had a record number of homicides last year and is on pace to possibly surpass that number this year. Mayor Ethan Berkowitz took some heat for comments he made last week when he said residents who were not involved in drugs or out after midnight were safe. He apologized a day later, saying he wishes he could undo those comments. He says when crime happens to someone in the city, he feels the weight.
And it's important to make sure that people who are victimized by crime or concerned about crime know that I have that sympathy and that I have that understanding. And I need to make sure that I convey that at all times.
What are you hearing, Mayor, from residents about their level of concern over safety? People should be able to expect the city to be safe no matter what time of day it is.
You know, there's different ways of answering that question. I've always looked at the ability to generate a safe community is dependent on what we're doing to prevent crime, what we're doing to police it, how are we prosecuting it, what sort of punishments are in place. And the city only has the ability to exert levers on the policing. We have very little prosecutorial power. Most of the crime, the serious crime in the state, is charged at the state or at the federal level. So we're also contending with the fact that we have an opioid epidemic and we are way short of the prevention piece here in terms of the detox facilities as well as the outreach.
As you're well aware, we have Nixle alerts that go out. There's a lot of social media sites, mm-hmm. Facebook, Nextdoor, there's other sites. Do you find those helpful or do they fuel the perception that crime is rampant?
Well, police have been very appreciative of the help they've received from the public. They've been able to generate leads and successfully apprehend and arrest people who have committed crimes through Nixle. There's also the the reality that when people are intensely aware of everything that's going on in a community, those concerns tend to become exacerbated. There's a lot of really great things that are happening in Anchorage right now. We've grown the police department. We're going to have some more detox facilities come online. The state hopefully will resolve its fiscal gap and we'll be able to start to put more prosecutors back online and sort of restore the troopers to the levels that they had historically been. So there are a lot of things that are good that are happening. We sometimes, when we're caught in the social media world, we just see a small piece of the bigger picture.
There's been a lot of debate about SB 91. A lot of people seem to be blaming an uptick in petty theft and property crimes on SB 91 and a perceived inability by law enforcement to make arrests. What's your take on that perspective?
There's a lot of contributing factors to what's going on. Senate Bill 91 isn't even what they intended it to be. Senate Bill 91 was intended to replace incarceration with rehabilitation. Well, they restricted the discretion that police officers and prosecutors have, which I think is an unfortunate step, but they didn't backfill at the same time with putting the rehabilitation resources in place. And so in a little bit, we aren't even seeing SB 91 the way it was created. We're seeing half of SB 91, and that's part of the problem. But this is an instance where if the state would allow the municipality to do more things for ourselves and not dictate to us at the local level how things should be policed and prosecuted, then I think we'd have a better ability to take care of the situation here.
That was Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz addressing community concerns over crime in the city. A lawsuit filed in federal court this week seeks to remove the residency requirement for people gathering signatures for state ballot initiatives. To get a statewide voter initiative on the ballot, the sponsors must gather thousands of signatures. And for the signatures to be valid, the people gathering them must be Alaska residents. Political consultant and former Libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate Scott Kohlhaas says that that requirement is unconstitutional. Kohlhaas is working to get four potential ballot initiatives before voters. He says the law has for years placed an extra burden on initiative sponsors in terms of who they can hire. Kohlhaas says that limits their constitutional rights to free speech, political association, and to petition the government.
You can't live on love. The way that the system is set up is that only the best organized and the best financed groups are going to get an issue on the Alaska state ballot.
Kohlhaas and an out-of-state man who wants to work as a signature gatherer are the two plaintiffs in the lawsuit filed Tuesday. The state says it is reviewing the complaint. Assistant Attorney General Elizabeth Bacalar says only the legislature or a court order can change the residency requirement. Bacalar says the review and any subsequent response from the state could take 3 weeks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Education scholarships and grants for ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, are available. To learn where the possibilities this education can take you, visit beanengineeralaska.com. This community message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil. Energy lives here.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Volleybucks. Alaska's high school sports teams spend a lot of time and money on travel, but $15,000 and 2,000 miles for a single trip? That's unusual. Earlier this month, the Kotzebue girls volleyball team traveled to Sitka to play Mount Edgecombe and Sitka High School. KCAW's Sarah Gibson was there and has this story.
Good morning. Welcome to Sitka.
Mount Edgecombe's gym is pretty full for a Saturday morning. The school's Lady Braves are the state's defending volleyball champions, and they're hosting the Kotzebue Huskies. The game starts with chants, first from the Braves, and then from the Huskies.
We say,
Who let the dogs out? Who?
Because they're the Huskies, so who let the dogs out? Because they're not at home.
The Huskies are about as far from home as they can get and still be in Alaska, more than 1,000 miles. This is nearly every girl's first trip to Southeast. It takes a day to get here.
We left Kotzebue at 8 a.m. and we got here at almost 11.
11 p.m., that is. But the Huskies came to Sitka prepared.
Do you have the right outfits?
Mm-hmm. Extra tufts and a raincoat. Because their style.
These girls say high school sports are the way that a young person from Kotzebue gets to see new places. This is Cassidy Kramer.
Flights are just a lot of money, and you can't drive anywhere, so you have to fly. So sports is how you get out of the town in high school.
Way to go, Alana. Caitlin, with that, just hit it. Okay?
Christina Fields is the volleyball coach. She says sports are one of the few free, organized activities that keep kids busy and out of trouble.
If you're not into like outdoorsy things like camping or hunting or anything, there's basically nothing to do in Kotzebue.
So the school invests in sports. School districts generally share the cost of flying teams back and forth, and this trip to Sitka was especially expensive. Sitka High School donated $3,000, and Mount Edgecombe is providing room and board. With round-trip flights at $900 a head, the Kotzebue School District still spent $15,000.
Keep it up, Huskies!
And Husky fans, they had to pay their own way here, and some did.
Let's get the ball back!
Three Kotzebue moms are in the stands, wearing t-shirts with Mom Squad printed on the back. Karina Kramer says this game is a big deal in Kotzebue. Fans are following her Facebook updates and watching the live stream.
If those girls have family, they're online and they're cheering as much as we are, hollering at their TV sets or their computer screens at home.
Some of the moms played on this very volleyball team together in the 80s. Annie Howarth says back then they traveled to villages within 100 miles of Kotzebue.
You played Selawik, Norvik, you played Kiana, Notak.
Now, because of how regional rankings work, Kotzebue teams fly farther and play bigger teams. This has a price tag, but new benefits. Athletes accrue thousands of miles on airlines, and when they stop in Anchorage, they can fill bags with food and school supplies that are 2 to 3 times as expensive in Kotzebue. And then there's seeing a different part of Alaska. Allie Martin is on her first big trip.
I didn't expect a lot of trees or mountains.
It's way different.
That's Cassidy.
In Kotzebue, you can see for miles and miles and miles. Like, you'll stand on a hill and you can see caribou that are miles away.
Cassidy's impression of Sitka?
It's so pretty. I love it. We saw a whale today. It's so cool. And we saw its, like, water spew up.
This trip is also special for the coach, Christina Fields. She became head coach last month.
When I decided to coach, I was pretty excited to come here.
That's because Fields knows Sitka. 7 years ago, she was a star athlete at Mount Edgecombe. Now her little sister is a student here. Fields says the Edgecombe coaches made a big difference in her life.
I wanted to be a coach like them, like they were for me.
Like they were for her, meaning they pushed her and gave her confidence. To make this trip worth it, the Huskies played 4 matches and 1 scrimmage in less than 48 hours. By the end, Fields says they're feeling
very tired. I thought it was like 11 p.m. after a game, and then I feel like I'm trying to stay up all night right now.
These trips are fun but exhausting, and when the team's energy is low, that's the hardest time to coach.
I still have yet to find out what would help them, but I'm going to be Googling a lot of mental drills that I can do with the team.
The Huskies lost both games to Mount Edgecombe and won both their games against Sitka High School. The next time they might play these teams is in November at the state championships in Anchorage. Reporting in Sitka for AK, I'm Sarah Gibson.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Jay Stange of Anchorage. Stange is a math teacher at Diamond High School.
I was born in Whitehorse, Yukon Territory, and I was adopted by a family that brought me to Alaska. And I grew up in Juneau and then came to Spinard in 1975 when I was 9. And went to Woodland Park Elementary, which is a closed school that's just down the street from my house right now. I teach at Dunman High School, and you know, I'm 51 years old, and I've been teaching high school for 7 years, so I came about being a teacher in a weird way. I was working as a project manager. I was basically helping people insulate houses all over Alaska and building homes off the grid with some friends of mine. It was the summer solstice and I had a bunch of people staying here, and my couch surfing guest showed up. She was late. She was the only couch surfing guest that ever called on the telephone to make sure that I got the message that she was coming, right? And then she was late. And I go down to the airport to pick her up because she calls late, right? She gets in my work truck. And you gotta understand, at the time, you know, I'm like a basically this like random Alaska carpenter dude. And she gets in the truck and I just take a quick glance in the back of my scary white panel van. There's two chainsaws. There's like random tools all over the place. It's filthy, you know, there's like wrappers everywhere. And she gets in and she doesn't even notice. She just starts telling me a story. I don't know, there's something about her. You know, I came home and I was like, hey, do you want the half hour bike tour of Spinard before I go back to work? And she was like, yeah. And she gets in, she can't ride a bike. She's like the only girl in Brooklyn that can't ride a bike, right? So we did the best we could. And, you know, one thing leads to another, you know, and I end up like falling in love with this girl. And I went out to visit her that winter in New York City. And I didn't come back for 5 years. When I came back, I had two kids, I was married, and I was a school teacher.
Jay Stange lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Sarah Gibson and Samantha Davenport. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, and Casey Grove in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of operations in Alaska.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The REAA School Board election is October 3rd. Polls are open at 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. When you go vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the register, you may vote a question ballot. If you need language or other assistance while voting, you may ask the election board or bring a person of your choice to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.